From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we try to put the messy politics aside and look at how the coming health care overhaul will change the picture for various groups. How will it affect young adults, businesses, small and large, those who have employer health insurance, and those with low and moderate incomes? My guests, Todd Linden, President and CEO of the Grinnell Regional Medical Center, and Peter Damiano, Director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Share your health insurance experience this hour and see how that may change under the new rules. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we look at how we Iowans will be affected by the historic health care reform legislation signed into law last month. And we want to try as much as possible, try to put the messy, heated politics that we've debated and reported on aside for this hour, and look at how the coming health care overhaul will change the picture for various groups. For instance, for young adults, small businesses, for those who have employer health insurance, and for those with low and moderate incomes, perhaps for you. Share your health insurance experience this hour and see how that might change under the new rules. And what have you been hearing about the healthcare situation and how you will be affected? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. A little note here, later in the hour, we'll be joined by Joseph Folsom. He's the director of the Iowa Small Business Administration. He'll give us details on how small businesses will be affected by the health care overhaul. So we want to steer the question specifically about small business and health care toward the end of the hour. Joining us, first of all, Todd Linden. He is president and CEO of Grinnell, the Grinnell Regional Medical Center, joining us by phone, I assume from Grinnell. Good afternoon, Todd.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great to have you with us. Also with us, Peter Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. He's joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Dr. Damiano is a professor of preventive and community dentistry in the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. And welcome to you, Dr. Damiano.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
And we want to emphasize for those not acquainted with the Public Policy Center that you direct, it is not an advocacy group.
That's correct. We are a research center and do research in a number of different areas. One of those is healthcare and health policy. We do work with people at the state and federal level through different types of funded research. And so we're not coming in with an agenda or take sides on the healthcare reform law or bill, anything like that.
Okay. Todd Linden, let's begin with you. As the chief administrator of the Grinnell Regional Medical Center, this is an 81-bed private nonprofit hospital in Grinnell. What do you see as the biggest changes coming your way?
Well, I think from a hospital perspective, we're on the cusp of starting to rearrange the way the government perhaps pays for Medicare, and that's going to have a big impact in Iowa and obviously for many of our patients across the state. In our community, 50% of all the activity at our hospital is for Medicare patients, and then another 10% for Medicaid, which of course is the state organized but 2/3 federally funded, 1/3 state funded program for the poor, and so about 60% of all of our activity in our community is government funded, and this new legislation begins to address the fact that there's dramatic geographic variation in what Medicare spends for patients across the country. In some cases, a 3- and 4-fold difference in Medicare expenditures per capita. And in Iowa, we're at the very low end of what government spending for beneficiaries. And in other parts of the country, it's dramatically more. And this bill, from my standpoint, the most significant part about this bill is it begins to say, wow, we got to do something about this geographic variation. The government needs to drive more value out of what they pay for health care. Mm-hmm. Wonderful value in Iowa. They pay very little and get a high quality. And perhaps for the first time, we're starting to see the government saying we need to acknowledge and recognize that and perhaps incent payment based on low cost, high quality.
Mm-hmm. So when you say begin to address this issue, what specifically, without getting into too many details that might be above our head, what does that mean to begin to address the Medicare difference between Iowa and the rest of the country?
Two things. This legislation requires the Secretary for Health and Human Services to formally study this geographic variation and by 2012 start putting in things in place for Medicare and presumably Medicaid to begin dealing with this geographic variation in payment. So that's where it starts. The second thing that this bill does is, and our legislators had a lot to do with both of these components. In particular, I was working with Congressman Braley and Congressman Boswell and Congressman Lobsack. They were particularly working on this issue as well as our two senators. But the issue was in the final hours of getting the votes to pass the Senate version of the health reform bill in the House of Representatives, our representatives put in or got $800 million put into this bill to increase payment to the lowest 25% of the counties in the country. So mm-hmm. This wasn't a Cornhusker deal or the Gatorade or the Louisiana purchase grab. This was just recognizing that there are hospitals and doctors across the country that get paid well below the national average, and this money is meant to prop that up while we begin to really study and then put in some fixes to get this geographic variation changed.
Would you say that all medical centers, all hospitals in Iowa, because of this one issue alone, are in better shape under the reform?
Absolutely, and to put it in perspective, the part that's the concern is, As you've undoubtedly reported, this is a big insurance change. We're going to get 32 million Americans access to health insurance over the next decade, and it costs $940 billion. And $500 billion of that is going to come from changes in Medicare. And for Iowa hospitals over the next 10 years, we're going to see a decrease in the funding for Medicare. And unfortunately, now, theoretically, $157 billion less payment to hospitals over the next 10 years, but there's going to be people that have insurance that didn't have before that we provide free care or low-cost care to. And so what's going to happen if we were one big hospital across the country, that decreased Medicare payment would be offset by folks that now have insurance. Unfortunately, it isn't one big hospital across the country. And states like Iowa, where we have a already high proportion of our population covered by Medicare and a low portion of our population that's uninsured, we're going to, as a state, lose out on that proposition of cutting Medicare and increased insurance coverage. Places like California are going to make out like crazy because they've got a big uninsured population and a relatively per capita, a relatively low percentage of folks on Medicare, and their Medicare payments are higher to start with. So we absolutely in this state have to keep pushing for this value-based approach to healthcare. We've been subsidizing other parts of the country for years through the Medicare program, and this is going to be it's the most fundamental part of this bill that's going to affect hospitals and how they hopefully get paid in the future more based on the value they provide the government and taking good care of Medicare patients in our state.
Dr. Damiano of the UI Public Policy Center, who in the state will be most affected by this reform?
Well, there's different aspects of the reform that I think it's important to separate out as you're beginning to look at what the impacts are. The first are those that are directly related to the delivery system, and then the other is related to the financing. And this bill, as it worked its way through, really was driven much more toward the financing side and health insurance coverage and things like that. And within the health insurance aspect, the two groups that really are going to benefit the most from that are going to be people who purchase insurance through the individual insurance market and those small businesses that also purchase insurance. Because I think it's important to understand that in Iowa, for example, 75% of the people in the state with health insurance are actually outside of state regulation because of something called ERISA. And so they are covered through employers who are self-insured. Mm-hmm. So it's the people that actually go out and buy insurance where those companies don't.
That, just to be clear, that 75% yes. will not be affected. They just stay the way they are?
Well, for the most part, I wouldn't say there aren't any spillover effects. And there's a lot of things that are going to be yet to be determined. But for the most part, the changes in here and are going to be aimed towards people who are purchasing on the individual and small business market.
Mm-hmm. Now, as it turned out, we did not end up with a public government-run public option competing with private insurers. We have something called healthcare exchanges. Is that what you're talking about affecting this 25% left over?
Well, that's who, when the mandate comes in 2014 for individuals to purchase health insurance, they've chosen what I would call sort of a center and almost a center-right approach on how you might approach this. There was a lot of talk during the political stage of this, as you said. Hopefully we're moving from the political stage to the policy stage about government takeovers and all of these kinds of things. But if you look at historically, the approach we've taken is really something closer to what Richard Nixon had proposed in the early 70s and something that Bob Dole had proposed when he was campaigning and something that Mitt Romney, even though he's now is sort of arguing that is not exactly what he did, but it's very similar to what Massachusetts did, and that's the model for these health insurance exchanges where we're taking the people who are currently uninsured and saying that you have to purchase health insurance and where the first phase of these people, the lowest income, will be picked up in public insurance programs, primarily in Medicaid, up to 133% of poverty. And this is what's going to be phasing in 2014. Then beyond that, people are going to be purchasing insurance through these regulated health insurance exchanges, which is sort of a health insurance bazaar or marketplace. Companies will be putting in products into this that people will then purchase. Lower income people above the lowest income above 133% of poverty will be subsidized to purchase their product, and then that goes up to about four times the federal poverty level, and they'll be getting some sort of a phased subsidy up to that. But we're basically driving about 24 million people into the private health insurance market. So it's not a government takeover from that that extent. It's driving into the private market, and then in exchange, the private insurers are saying that they'll now cover pre-existing conditions and some things like that, which they said they couldn't without these new people into the market.
Less than a minute before we have to take a break. With more people insured, would you expect hospitals like those of Todd Linden in Grinnell to have more patients because they are seeking more care earlier instead of waiting until an emergency?
Well, that's the hope, is that this will ultimately affect health status. And, you don't know exactly. Some of these people, we know the uninsured, do tend to seek care later and when they are sicker. So the hope is now that they have insurance coverage that they will come in for more preventive care. And then we can talk about that issue of the public insurance option, the public option, where that was to fit in the exchange in a moment, if you'd like.
Okay, just we'll take a short break, but be back with Dr. Peter Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, Todd Linden, president and CEO of Grinnell's Regional Medical Center. We'd like to reach out to you to have you share your health insurance experience this hour and how that might change under the new rules. What have you been hearing about your healthcare situation and how it will be affected? Here's a chance to get an answer to your question. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Now that it has been enacted into law, signed into law last month, we want to put politics aside for the hour and ask how the health care reform will affect us. Todd Linden of Grinnell Regional Medical Center with us. Dr. Peter Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. We invite you with your questions and comments, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Professor Damiano, you were talking about the public option, which didn't come into being. We have these exchanges. The understanding was that the public option was supposed to create some competition with the private sector improve prices, improve service. Does that happen with this exchange you've been describing?
Well, I think the public option was a fascinating case study of a lot of the political debate, that on one side it was a panacea and we couldn't have anything without it. On the other side, it was evil and was going to, cause all kinds of havoc. And the reality is, of course, it's neither. The idea was, as we're putting these public products or private products into this exchange? How could we create competition to get the prices in the exchange to something that would be reasonable without mandating the prices? And we were very willing and chose not to mandate prices. So many states in this, again, the individual and small business market is what we're talking about. There's one insurance company that dominates. For example, Walmart Blue Cross Blue Shield has about 70% of the individual market in Iowa. So if they're putting their product into this, what's going to compete with it to try to drive down the price? And so there were some people that believed that the public having a public option, a buy-in to Medicaid or Medicare or something like that would create some competition. The politics of that obviously got very raucous. So what they chose instead to do is they're going to have a co-op. And again, it's not entirely clear how this is going to work or how successful it was, but each state is supposed to be creating a nonprofit co-op as one of the competitors. Then there are also going to be, through the federal employees insurance product, will be a couple of options from that that will be available nationwide to try to create some competition.
An email from Kenneth just came in. He wants Todd Linden to comment on the supply of doctors to keep up with all these new patients. Kenneth comments, writes, my father waited 2 weeks to see a specialist who was overbooked with patients. What do you have to say to that, Todd Linden? You're looking for many more patients to come to a medium-sized medical center such as yours?
Well, again, you know, in a state like Iowa, where we've had a higher percentage of folks covered by insurance, it's not going to be quite as noticeable as perhaps other parts of the country, but certainly, as folks have perhaps greater access to healthcare, we'll see some increase in patient activity. The bigger issue is just the acute need for physicians in general in rural America. And certainly in our case, we're recruiting right now for orthopedics, internal medicine, OBGYN, ENT. Those are all current active searches right now. And the reality is it isn't just hospitals that have been paid lower in Iowa than surrounding states and the rest of the country. It's physicians as well. So when more and more physicians are coming out of school with large amounts of educational debt, taking a look at what their income level is going to be and recognizing that there's a difference around the country, that I think is going to be our biggest challenge in Iowa is not only recruiting folks and competing on an income basis, but frankly, when you're in a smaller environment, then there are issues of lifestyle as well. Being on call, sharing call with half a dozen or a dozen other physicians in a larger community is much different than a small town where perhaps you're on call every other night, every other weekend, or even every third night or every third weekend. That's pretty onerous, and many folks are interested in being able to spend more time with their families than what perhaps their the past generation did with the practice of medicine. So I think that's going to be the challenge is finding a relatively scarce resource in the first place and then attracting to a state like Iowa where we've got some disadvantage on government payment levels.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Damiano, do you see any this healthcare reform addressing this shortage that we have in Iowa, specifically the shortage of primary caregivers, in any way by this reform?
There are aspects that do relate to the healthcare reform, to the delivery system side of things related to it, but I agree that that's going to be one of the biggest issues we're going to be facing is the number of primary care providers, particularly as we move toward what's been called a medical home model for delivery of care and trying to coordinate services better and improve quality and make things more efficient. And that's where ultimately we're going to get some cost savings from the delivery side of things. We don't have an adequate supply of primary care providers anywhere in the country for the most part, I mean, other than isolated places. And as Todd brought up, the whole issue of coming out of school with debt, primary care providers earning less, there's fewer people going into primary care now, and that's going to be a huge issue that's going to need to be addressed, I think, in more direct detail in the future than is in the current bill.
So we mentioned at the outset the University of Iowa Public Policy Center is not an advocacy group. So let me ask you, in gathering information about this reform and as we envision its enactment, implementation, what aspects are drawing the most criticism from those who are deeply involved with healthcare policy that you can point to?
Well, in terms of what I think are some of the big unknowns, and we'll have to see how it works out, the number one is how do we keep the prices of the insurance products in the exchange at something that is affordable? And that's one of the problems that's happening in Massachusetts. They started these exchanges about 3 years ago, and initially they had a pretty good agreement with the insurance companies that the products that they were putting into this exchange were at a reasonable price and something that could be afforded both by the government because of the subsidies that are going in as well as the people that were purchasing straight out-of-pocket costs. Now they're facing that those costs have gone up rapidly and they don't have enough funds within that system to keep it going. I think the same question here, how do the insurance products from the private market come into this exchange at a price that's actually affordable both from the individuals but also from us as taxpayers that are subsidizing this?
Mm-hmm. Kathy writes an email. She says, Iowa now allows non-students up to the age of 25 who remain in Iowa to remain on our insurance. When will insurance companies have to allow young people up to 26 years old under the new reform to remain on insurance plans no matter where they live? Dr. Damiano.
That's as of this fall. There's a number of aspects of the bill that are going to be implemented yet this year. It's been sort of phased in. They put some of the very desirable aspects right up front, as you might imagine.
The ones that will be felt immediately that are good for elections, for example.
It could be. I can't imagine they would do that. But, for example, being able to stay on your parents' insurance up to age 26 is going to affect this fall. Same with no longer allowing pre-existing conditions for purchasing health insurance on the private market again, individual insurance market for children. So there's some things like that that are going to be coming into place right away that are going to be very, I think, desirable for people. There's a number of others, but I think those are the two that jump out the most.
We've talked about Medicare and a step, what was described as a step in the right direction there to benefiting Iowa more. Aside from that, can you tell us, Dr. Damiano, how will Iowa be affected uniquely compared to other U.S. states? For example, here we had the age of 25 in Iowa. That's not much of a change, 25 to 26. I imagine other states have a greater jump.
Right. That's true. Todd alluded to this earlier, that we've done a pretty good job in Iowa in terms of the number of uninsured, particularly with children, where we're at somewhere around 3 to 5%. And in terms of those that are eligible because of expansions in the Medicaid program and the Hawkeye program, the state's children's health insurance program, we're really at an eligibility probably closer to 99% of children that are eligible for some sort of public insurance. Not all of them have enrolled in Medicaid or Hawkeye. And then we've already had the Iowa Care program for expansion of adults up to 100% of poverty. The provider network isn't as broad and some things like that, which we could talk about. But we did have those things in place. So we've got a slightly smaller pool of uninsured adults as a result of that. So we are better positioned in some ways than other states for this.
Todd Linden, we have less than a minute before we have to take a break. But I want to ask, if we would go to your hospital in the next few years and if we wouldn't really know it, the structure, the staff, and how you go about it, how do you imagine you'll be adjusting to this health care reform?
Well, I think health care reform in general, but even more dramatic, is going to be the need for us to continue to improve the quality of the service and decrease the cost. The reality is nobody can afford health care today. The government can't afford health care for Medicare, Medicaid. Individuals can't afford health care if they're uninsured, and companies are finding health care unaffordable in terms of their costs. And so the reality is we've just got to work much more diligently in bringing the cost down associated with delivery of health care. And this bill started to address that, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Okay, we'll take a short break and be back with Todd Linden, President and CEO of the Grinnell Regional Medical Center. Also with us, Dr. Peter Damiano, Director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. We invite you to join our conversation. And when we do come back, Joseph Folsom will join us, Director of the Iowa Small Business Administration, will tell us what's in store for small business as a result of these changes in the health care reform. Perhaps you're a business owner, a small business owner, would like to ask a question. What are your hopes or concerns about how it may change your situation? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange. Glad you could join us over the noon hour. And this hour, we look at how we Iowans will be affected by the historic health care reform legislation that was signed into law last month. We're trying to, as much as possible, put the messy politics aside that we've debated and reported on, at least for this hour, and look at how the coming health care overhaul will change the picture for various groups. And if we'd like to join our you'd like to join our conversation, share your healthcare experience, especially if you're a small business owner or somehow connected with a small business, that will be our emphasis in this final section of our program. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We have with us Todd Linden, President and CEO of Grinnell, the Grinnell Regional Medical Center, Dr. Peter Damiano, Director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Now joining us as well, Joseph Folsom. He is Director of the Iowa Small Business Administration. As the District Director, Joe is responsible for the management and delivery of the Small Business Administration's financial assistance, business development, and counseling programs throughout Iowa. He joins us by phone. Good afternoon to you, Joseph Folsom.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
And what are the major ways this reform will affect small business in Iowa?
Well, there are actually several different ways. There is a health care tax credit to help small businesses lower the cost of providing health care coverage to their workers, and we'll talk a little more about that. As mentioned earlier, the health insurance exchanges, which would increase the bargaining power and reduce some of the overhead administrative costs. And down the road, there are some additional provisions which would help reduce price discrimination against small businesses that have sick workers. Say you have only a small labor pool and you have a higher rate of illness or injury, and that typically immediately affects your rates, and there be a way to soften some of that. And I think all in all, there are, bring all these pieces together, it's hopeful that with the ability to provide health care coverage and some stability in the cost of it, we can open up the opportunities for entrepreneurship and small business development.
So go into that more. With the things that you've listed, how do you believe it will affect this reform will affect entrepreneurship in the state? The establishment of more small businesses?
I really think when you take out some of the significant barriers or reduce the cost of them, you increase the opportunity for small businesses to do several things. One, they can hire quality workers. They can lower the cost of being able to get that workforce in place, and provide more stability to that workforce, because you obviously can provide better health care coverage for them, so that it improves your workforce quality.
Tell us more about the small business health care tax credits.
That's actually an item that's available right now to small businesses. It's actually retroactive to January 1st of this year. And for small businesses that employ up to 25 full-time workers and have an average annual salary of under $50,000, there is immediately available this year up to a 35% tax credit that they can take to lower the cost of their premiums. The one other caveat is that in the providing of the health care coverage, they need to the employer needs to pay at least 50% of that premium. Going down the road in 2014, that tax credit actually increases to 50%.
Let's go to our first caller. We want to have as many callers as possible in this last half hour to share healthcare experiences with insurance. What are your questions about how this may or may not affect you, especially if you're connected with a small business? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, joining us first of all from Fairfield. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Even pretty small businesses sometimes have self-insured plans. This was mentioned earlier, and I didn't understand whether the new requirements are going to affect employees whose employers have self-insured plans, like covering children up to 26, or there are no maximum limits on the amount of insurance coverage.
Joe Folsom, can you address that?
I'm actually not familiar with the number of firms or firms that are doing, very small firms that do self-insurance. So it's going to be a little difficult to answer, but my sense is that for small firms the opportunity to participate in these health insurance exchanges where there's an opportunity to provide more choice and lower costs through greater bargaining power, particularly if you're a firm. I believe these exchanges will be open to firms that have less than 100 employees. I think those will be some real cost savers.
Dr. Damiano, what is the mandate for health care for businesses under this new reform?
Well, one of the issues that or the phases of this that we're going through is where it's moved from the legislative phase over to the administrative phase, if you will. So it's moved from the Congress over to the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level and then the state level, and now they're going to be working on all the implementation issues. You know, even though it was a 2,000-page bill, that really didn't provide the detail for many of these things. So as we talk about this, just to sort of keep that in mind, that a lot of this is going to be a moving target over the next, you know, anywhere from 4 to 10 years, basically, or until 2019 when the last part of this gets phased in. But in terms of that regard, the language that I have seen is that the provision applies to all health plans in terms of that covering children in the plan up to 26. And one of the reasons that this was done is that it's a very low cost approach to pick up about one-third of the uninsured, one-quarter to one-third, who are in that, coming off their parents' insurance, graduating from college, starting with a business that generally does not provide health insurance, can't afford it. And so we can pick up all of these people at relatively low cost. And so it was sort of cherry-picking as a start. It's also a very popular approach.
Okay, thank you, Ellen from Fairfield. Let's go to Nikki in Cedar Rapids. Good afternoon, Nikki. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call. I actually have a question for a friend of mine. She has a genetic neurological disorder. Both her grandmother and her father had it, and both of them passed away due to complications from this disorder. And she... with her job, insurance is available, but it's just not affordable. It's over $200 a pay period. And so I guess my question to you is, what will this health care reform be able to provide to her? She has over $100,000 in medical bills just from having complications from this neurological disorder. And so I guess I want to know, how will this new bill help her? And then also, second part of the question is, I know President Obama says that health care should be affordable to everyone. What determines what affordable health care is?
A couple of good questions. Let's go with that specific question. I'm going to toss this to Dr. Damiano. I think he can handle those. We'll see.
Yeah. In terms of the person with the disability, although it sounds like the person is working. I mean, one option is public insurance through Medicaid that has a component called the Supplemental Security Income Program. I'm guessing this person has looked into that, where you can get public insurance coverage. But one of the things specifically, one of the new initiatives that's going to happen right away is what's called the National High Risk Pool. And that's supposed to begin 90 days after enactment of the bill. And that's for people with pre-existing conditions. And it'll be some sort of subsidized coverage. The big problem with high-risk pools in the past, and most of them have not been terribly successful in terms of picking up a lot of these people, is that the cost does continue to be very high. When you create the exchanges and you have the mandated coverage and you're putting basically all of these people into something closer to resembling community rating, the old-fashioned Blue Cross Blue Shield way of rating everybody more similarly, you know, that might also help this person, but it's hard to say specifically what this is going to do for those, the actual premiums. Is it going to be affordable? And your question of what is affordability, to me, is one of those huge questions that's left. How are we going to determine that the prices of the products in this exchange, when we're mandating that people purchase it, are affordable? I think that's yet to be determined.
Thank you, Nikki from Cedar Rapids. Also, an email that goes to this question of affordability, a specific case here as well. Melita writes, my husband lost his job 14 months ago, and we have been on COBRA insurance, which will end soon. He is employed now without insurance, and we have been trying to find private insurance, but none will take him because of pre-existing conditions. This health bill will not help us for a couple of years, but who is to say that the insurers will accept us with pre-existing conditions at that time, but not make the price of that coverage totally unaffordable? Melita asks, will they agree to insure us, but only at an enormous premium? Dr. Damiano, another one for you, I think. An unknown.
I mean, again, a similar answer. The national high-risk pool, again, is going to be going into place soon. Will that bring the cost down to something that's affordable for this person? I mean, that's a big question.
I want to talk to you, Todd Linden, about uncompensated care. I see that the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee has a website giving detailed information for each congressional district about certain aspects of this health care reform. For the district in which your hospital is located, Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, the reform is projected to reduce the cost of uncompensated care for hospitals and other health care providers by $65 million annually. What falls into the category of uncompensated care coming through your door?
Well, of course, it starts with our charity care program. So based on income, we have a sliding scale of totally free care, a couple hundred percent of poverty, right through to 25-75 split, 50-50, 25-75. So depending on people's income levels, they can qualify for reduced or free care. So that's certainly the largest portion of uncompensated care. Then you start to move into things like bad debt. Obviously, as our economy has weakened, we've seen more people not be able to pay their portion. Perhaps they're even insured, but their copays or deductibles have gone up dramatically and haven't been able to pay. And so we've got a lot of folks that are on, you know, paying us $5 or $10 a month towards a multi-$1,000 bill, and folks that altogether haven't been able to pay. So our both bad debt and charity care have gone up, especially in the last couple of years. Now, you could also argue that a big chunk of uncompensated care in this state is the below-cost payment for Medicare and Medicaid, which I spoke on earlier. I think people are kind of surprised to know that we have some of the lowest-cost care in the country, and yet in my hospital, for example, the government pays anywhere between 75 to 80% of the actual cost. So last year, for example, we got paid $2.5 million less than we actually spent, not our charges, but what we spent taking care of Medicare and Medicaid patients. And so I would lump in that uncompensated care the subsidy that everybody else is paying for government-sponsored care.
And so this will improve your bottom line.
Well, theoretically, the notion here that people that will suddenly have access to some insurance product that they currently are either qualifying for charity care or can't pay for their care, theoretically that's gonna help. But remember, there's a $157 billion reduction in Medicare payment to hospitals over the next 10 years to help pay for that coverage. So the question is, are those going to equal out or not? And the answer in Iowa is absolutely not. There's no possible way that we're going to see an increased bottom line because of the legislation specific to reductions in Medicare in exchange for increasing access to care for the uninsured.
Peter Damiano, to add to that, his point on the uncompensated care?
I think Todd touched on two things we haven't really addressed yet. One is the growing number of the underinsured. Most people are aware of the 47 million people estimated. Some will argue with that number that are uninsured. But there's been an increasing number of people, now estimated to be at least 25 million, who are underinsured because employers' costs are getting up to be so high that they've had to reduce coverage for the employee or reduce dependent coverage. And so the coverage doesn't cover as much as it used to. Todd also touched on something that could be a benefit to others, is that as we're starting to pay for this uncompensated care, in theory, those of us with private insurance or other types of insurance currently should see our costs going down because we're paying for that uncompensated care other than what the providers are eating, if you will. And so that should help hold down some costs over time. Whether those dollars will actually flow through the system in that way, again, we'll have to see.
I want to go back to you, Joe Folsom, director of the Iowa Small Business Administration. You talked earlier about discrimination, that this will end price discrimination for small business. Explain what that means.
Well, when you have a small employee base or pool of workers that are covered, if you have a higher level of risk because of that particular pool, be it age or some particular illnesses that may have occurred, then you end up with having to getting assessed higher premiums. And if you could expand that pool to a larger number of participants, then you're able to mitigate that risk and bring down some of those costs and premiums.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to this email and toss it to Todd Linden of the Grinnell Regional Medical Center. This is from Stephen. Stephen comments, when the cost of health care is so extraordinary, why then, when I visit patients in hospitals, do I see million-dollar water fountains and serenity gardens, expensive amenities which have nothing to do with the delivery of high-quality health care? Todd Linden.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, one of the things I'm probably most disappointed in terms of this bill is we didn't spend a lot of time dealing with how to drive waste out of the system. A New England Journal of Medicine article recently suggested that as much as 30% of the current care provided in this country is clinically unnecessary. And there's lots of reasons for that. Some of it's defensive medicine. We do things to cover the backside. Some of it is demand from consumers in terms of what they're looking for, some of the amenities like were just mentioned. Some of it's because there's duplication, some tests done here, and then someone gets referred for some additional care somewhere and they repeat the same tests. There's a lot of reasons why there's waste in our system. And if you consider, if that's true, 30% of what we do in this country today is not clinically necessary, that's 5% of our gross domestic product, which is probably more than most countries' entire economies. If we spent more time working on getting the waste out of the system, we probably could afford to deliver more care to folks. Specific mm-hmm. to the question, the reason you see some of that is because some people choose to go to providers that have atriums and fountains and other kinds of amenities. They find that, there's a competition still for patients, and especially in multi-hospital communities, you might see a little bit more of that. In our institution, we've worked really hard to make comfortable healing environments, but certainly not opulent. And I think that's there's going to be more of that does end up coming out of the system simply because the reimbursements are going to be less. But we probably need a lot more work on trying to figure out how to use evidence-based care to drive more of the waste out of the system.
Peter Damiano, you wanted to join in on this point.
Another sort of aspect of waste, if you will, is the administrative costs of the insurance products. And one of the early provisions in the bill is going to mandate that insurers can only spend up to 15% of the premiums that they bring in on administrative costs. And that was one of the thing that was driving some people about the public insurance option is actually Medicare and Medicaid, governments often criticized for being inefficient, is actually a much more efficient system. And their overhead costs are about 68% just because it's all automated, it's all electronic, everybody fills out the same forms and codes. And then it's 6 to 8% is okay. What it's estimated at. Mm-hmm. And it's actually processed by some private companies. Where on the private insurance side, it runs anywhere from 12 to 25% because you've got insurance agents all over, you've got still people who are doing some hand filled out forms and things like that. So they're trying to squeeze the private insurance companies to be more efficient on the administrative side as a part of the health care reform bill.
We're getting close to the end of the hour. I wanted to have you comment, and now that you sort of broke the ice with that example right there, in the mainstream media, what you've heard debated about health care and about specifically about this bill, what are some of the biggest myths that you have to shake your head at because you just know that is not in this reform and couldn't be?
Well, the killing grandma was obviously the one that was talked about.
Pulling the plug on grandma.
Yes, pulling the plug on grandma, which is actually a great example of how this whole thing can get distorted because it was a Republican member of the House that put in a provision so that physicians could be reimbursed for end-of-life counseling. Because right now, if they do end-of-life counseling with a patient, which I think we would all believe is a good thing to do, they couldn't be reimbursed. And so that was put into one of the early versions of the healthcare reform bill. That then got twisted by opponents to then say, well, what we're trying to do is pull the plug on grandma.
Mm-hmm. Todd Linden, do you have any myths out there you want to explode or concluding comments?
Well, I think I don't know about myths per se. I think one of the things especially Iowans need to recognize is on a per capita spending basis, on average, the government spends $8,000 per beneficiary in the country. And in Iowa, it's well below that. It's as high as $15,000 in Graceville, Florida, and as low as $3,600 in Idaho. But if you look at the lowest 50 communities in the country where Medicare gets the best buy. There, it's in Iowa, and I think Iowans need to recognize that we need to be vigilant about going forward to make sure that the resources that do come out from government are taking advantage of the fact that we've got relatively low cost and high quality care in the state, and we should lead as we go forward.
Joseph Folsom, director of the Iowa Small Business Administration. On balance, as we go out ending this program, what would you say the effect of health care reform on small business in Iowa? A very good thing on balance?
I really do. And as I started studying this, one of the things that really popped out at me were the provisions on the health care tax credits. The research that has been put together shows that a little over 48,000 Iowa small businesses would really benefit from that. And I started looking at, as some of the examples were provided, and the impact on a small business can be significant. An example that is actually out on the SBA website and links back, I think, to one that the IRS provides, which is, by the way, going to the SBA website, which is www.sba.gov, or the IRS website are really good places for a small business to start to explore what some of those benefits are. But
we have just a few seconds.
Take an example of a small business that it puts out $70,000 in health care costs. This 35% tax credit could save them $24,000.
We'll have to leave it there. Sorry, Joe Folsom, we'll have to invite you back to expand on that as this develops our new health care reform. Joe Folsom, director of the Iowa Small Business Administration, thank you for being with us from our Des Moines studio.
You're welcome.
Peter Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Dr. Damiano, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Todd Linden, President CEO of the Grinnell Regional Medical Center. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks, Ben. It's been great.
Our Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, and our theme music by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.